We light our chalice with these words from Laurel S. Sheridan. Take from life its coals, not its ashes. Fan the flames of love and justice. Join hands and hearts in common endeavor, and there will be no limit to what we can achieve together.
So for this story, this morning story for all ages, I need all of the kids to come up, but we're going to have to sit in slightly different places. So if you'll come up, and we've got to also figure out how many we have this morning, just come up and we might have to rearrange ourselves. If you can, try to kind of group as many here in the center as you can. And let's see. If there's anyone who could sit on the floor, if we can really get a little bit tightly, and let's see. One, two. I need, so, if it's okay, if you can help me make one path right here. Is that okay? No, you're fine. I didn't give you instruction. It's my fault. So if you can help me make a path for someone to walk, because I'm going to need four volunteers. All right, so I see one hand. Come on up, Jordan. Two, three, and four in the dress. All right, let's go. All right, I've got four volunteers. I have three paths. We're close. I'm getting there. All right, I'm going to give you a sheet of paper. You can look at it, but don't show people what it is yet. Okay. This one's for you. And then you don't have a sheet of paper, it'll be clear in a minute. All right, so if you want to go over here, and this will be your path, okay? If you'll go up and down the steps, this will be your path. So if you'll start kind of back at that first pew where it's brown, and then whenever I tell you, I'll have you walk up here, okay? Same, if you want to go to the chairs, and when I tell you to walk up here, it'll be your turn. And then if you'll go over to, like, that table over there where the flowers are, it'll be your turn. And let's just make a path right through here. It might be a little hard, but we'll see if we can kind of slide through, okay? And maybe you can stand close to Laura. All right, perfect. So this is a story entitled Many Paths to God. It's adapted from another story from Mary Ann Moore, a UU. So I'm going to stand here out of the way. Once upon a time, there were four travelers. Four travelers, can you wave your hands so the adults and children remember who you are? Four travelers, off in the corners. Jordan's the other one. All right, four travelers from different lands, and they met near a mountain. The travelers had been told if they climbed the mountain, they would find God at the top. Now, around the bottom of the mountain, there were many paths to choose from. The travelers had each been told beforehand which of the paths they would take. And they had also been told that it was only their path that was the right way. Only the path that they could walk was the right way. And so they were at the bottom of the mountain, and they kind of told each other of their search for God. And so the first traveler, the one with the flowery meadow, who has that picture? Can you hold it up for everyone? It will be hard to see. But she's got a picture of a mountain, and there are flowers and a beautiful blue sky. This person, this path says, I am trying to find God. I've been told that of all these paths, the flowers will lead me along the way. And I know that if I follow it, at the top will be the great mother of all. The second person says, well, that's interesting. I've been told that I should take the path that looks kind of steep, like I might fall down. And that's Jordan. Jordan, can you turn around and show the adults too? So that's a set of rocks where, you know, if you're not careful, you might fall and get hurt. I'm told if I follow this, I'll find God, who's the great Father in heaven, which is different than the great Mother. The third path thought all of this was strange because they too had been told only their path was right, and that was the path of a beautiful, beautiful forest. So this is just a beautiful forest, probably in Alaska, with pine trees. And they were told that if they followed that into the deep forest, if they could breathe in the mountain air with the trees, they would find God. And then the fourth person, our dear friend without a picture, What do you think this person was told? What do you think?
Follow your heart.
Follow your heart. That's a really good one. I'm going to come back to that. What else? Do you, anyone other? Any other thoughts? Go ahead. You don't know? Okay, go ahead. Use your mind. So I think both of those are really good. Follow your heart and use your mind. And part what she was told was, just look around you. You don't know what you're going to find on your path, but your path is for you. And so look around you and see what you discern as you walk up there, and that's the important path up the mountain. So I like follow your heart and use your mind. Those are both good lessons, okay? All right, so the travelers were surprised to hear that anyone else had another path because they knew that their path was the only right one, right? So they tried to convince the others to go up their path. Can you all try to, like, go and show each other how your path is the best one? I mean, I think the trees look pretty awesome myself, which, let's do a show of hand. Who likes trees more than flowers? Who likes flowers more? Okay, who likes steep rock climbing? Who likes to rock climb? All right, that was a few hands, all right. And who, like, just likes to go for a walk and it doesn't matter what you find? That's awesome. That was the perfect path for you. Nice. Sweet. All right. So none of them would change. They kind of got very stubborn and stuck in their ways. Each was sure that their way was right because they had been told that they were right. So bidding each other goodbye, they began their journey to the top. So if you four will start to walk up our mountain here at Brew, climb to the top and head toward the chalice that lights the way at the very top, okay? As they started out, each was singing a song of praise to God. They could each hear each other's song in the distance, but they all thought they sounded strange from far away. But off they went on their chosen paths. They soon were traveling alone and could no longer hear the others, and sometimes they felt scared and alone. It was hard. Finally, each of them got to the top of the mountain. They began to hear other travelers' songs once again, but now they realized how beautiful it was to hear them and how the songs complemented each other. All four came to the top within mere seconds of each other. Can you believe this? In seconds of each other, they stopped and they looked around. The first one with the flowers said, "Oh, mother of all, I have found you." And the second person who had navigated the steep climb with the rocks said, "Oh, great father, I have found you." And the fourth, who was looking for silence and peace amongst the trees, said the same. And the third said that, and then the fourth, noticing what it was that she found in her heart and in her mind along the way, found peace and comfort. But all of them were seeing and calling out to the exact same thing. Then they realized that they had been searching for the same thing, though had taken different paths and called it by different names. At this, they reached out for each other's hands, formed a circle, and began to sing again. And now, as each of them sang their songs, there seemed to be only one song. A song of unity. So I invite you all, the children, to sing our song to the adults, and then the adults will sing theirs back, and you can head to religious education. Our reading this morning and our worship is about shared or common ground. This morning's reading is from a short story from Mark Manson, and it's going to be in several parts. So Ross, would you start?
At 8:12 p.m., a woman at table 5, tall, slim, brown hair, ground zero, center stage, stands and shrieks incomprehensibly, yet vulgar syllables at the man across from her. The restaurant pauses to watch. The woman launches the contents of her half-full wine glass at the man. The gentleman flinches, his eyes shut, and the Clos Pepe Pinot Noir 2005 splatters across his face, his tie, his collar, and dinner jacket, spattering the table and floor behind him. Under her chandelier spotlight, the woman sweeps herself up and out of the room in a huff of anger, exit stage left. Tears imminent, purse swinging, hand up to hail a cab before she's even out the door. The room holds its place for a moment, silent and waiting, watching, and then like a record slowly resuming speed, it revs back up to its natural rhythms and the clanks and hearts and heart murmurs.
At table 7, Lynn Marshall watched the woman and her drama with extra interest. Lynn felt disgusted. Proud, as independent, assertive, and active, bettering humanity, Lynn saw all of herself as these things. Lynn would not have thrown that wine at a man. She'd throw the whole bottle. Her self-assurance in that moment would appear to others as strength and others as arrogance. Lynn had thought about these things before. What Lynn didn't think about in that moment were the neighborhood boys who had thrown rocks at her as a child, or the cousin who assaulted her but she had been too afraid to report it to the police, or the way mom and dad always seemed to have time for everything except for her. She also didn't think of her stellar grades and her women's studies courses in college, or the way her activism brought out her independence and identity for the first time in life. How her feminist professors gave her strong role models to look up to and something to believe in, something to care about, a worthy cause that she knows can make a difference in the world. She didn't think of the rape statistics or the theories on gender or the patriarchy or the objectification of beauty. Really, she just thought, well, yet another jerk is in our midst, and said as much to her friend across the table. The statement spoke all of these things that she didn't have to.
At table 11, the woman's yelp almost made John Woodwin drop his neatly pasted fork onto his lap. John's reaction to this unexpected jolt was the same reaction he had to the most stressful events in his life, indignation. When the woman threw the wine, John didn't think of the wife who had divorced him for a guy who made half as much money. He didn't think about the high school girlfriend who left him in an eerily similar fashion either, without calling him or even notifying him directly. Even if he wanted to, he wouldn't have been able to think about the way he poured himself into his work, code, systems, logic, because it was the only thing in his life he felt he could control and predict. He didn't think of the way his mother babied him and overprotected him, gave him everything yet smothered him, reinforcing for him again and again and again that isolation and loneliness are best found in the arms of a woman, that love is equal to a lack of independence. He watched, and she left, and he thought, women are so irrational, she probably deserved whatever happened to her.
Marge and Bob Rowland, an elderly couple, sat at table 3. When the woman screamed, Marge's body swiveled the full 180 degrees in her chair like a cat caught off guard. Marge was attracted to drama of any sort these days, and she knew this. She also knew that little ever seemed to happen in her life anymore. What she didn't know that night was what was happening in the restaurant. Oh, my. What happened? She said in an exaggerated tone. To her, it didn't matter whose fault it was. It just mattered that there was a fault at all. These rare moments gave her a fleeting nostalgia for the passions of the past. It stoked a dark, unseen place inside Marge, a place that silently envied the woman in the black dress and her tears, a place that took a certain amount of excitement in viewing another in pain. I wonder what happened, she said again as she turned back to Bob. Bob never even looked up from his risotto. Instead, he kept shoveling it into his mouth. Marge would ask again, and then again, and then again, and at least 3 more times before the night was over. My goodness, what happened? It was like the chorus to a song Bob had been listening to for 56 years. He could predict every rhythm and every note as it came. He had fallen in love with that song and been sickened by that song 100 times and 100 times again. He had listened to it for so long that he had forgotten what it was like to not listen to it. Eat your food, Marjorie, he said after the 3rd chorus.
At table 16, Charles Taylor, alone at a corner table, overweight, messy, and bearded, looked up from his book, a recent translation of an old Chekhov favorite, to watch the commotion unfold. For Christ's sake, lady, that's a good wine you're throwing out, he thought, and then returned to his book. The maitre d' observed the events from the front of the restaurant. When the woman stood up and began walking toward him, his emotions swelled and his chest tightened as she walked past, as if in slow motion. He could detect the bounce of every curl in her hair, the sway of her hip, the crest of every tear about to erupt and flood her carefully designed face. His heart sped up. He himself began to find himself upset. In his mind, he was upset for the woman that she was so hurt, but he was also upset about being ignored, the years and years of being ignored and passed over, the sacrifice. The nights laying in bed, fantasizing, romanticizing about moments like this, moments where he could save her, be needed by her, where he could fall head over shoulders in love and tell her everything would be all right and it would be true. He was upset that the wine wasn't thrown on him instead. He moved. He followed her outside. As he ran after her, every dream and a desire to fix her, to be the one to rescue her, to earn her love in a single dramatic moment, to finally earn what he'd spent his whole life believing he deserved, came to the tip of his tongue and was then swallowed. "I can call you a taxi if you like," he said lamely. The tears told him no, and he lingered, ignored and forgotten, as always ignored.
Inside, the waiter rushed to the man's side to clean up the mess. While he wiped the wine off the man's suit and tie, the waiter bristled with a faint excitement. It buzzed and vibrated through his skin. Love, drama, anger, these moments were when he felt most alive. In the waiter's family, resentment and blame were how loved ones communicated. Wine thrown on someone's face was called Tuesday. He saw a certain romance in the pain on the man's face as he cleaned off the collar. This to him was what love felt like. It was the same hint of romance he felt the time his boyfriend hit him out of anger. He felt it beneath the pain and the sadness and the unbearable disappointment of the man he had chosen to be with, but it was there, barely. He felt it when he came out to his father and was disowned right on the spot. The role of the martyr. The undeserved punishment taken and carried for someone else, thankless. While being wiped clean, the man himself stared blankly ahead at the space in which she had previously inhabited her space. It was hers, and now another space is hers, and then another will be hers again. He could almost see the air rushing to fill the vacuum she left behind. The physics of it were just so perplexing. He stared on and on into the space. She would never inhabit the same exact space again. None of us do. Finally, after the wine was cleaned and the vacuum filled and the murmurs resumed, he calmly looked up to the waiter and asked, "Check, please." I often find myself entranced in moments like that story where I can see and hear the different perspectives that people carry on common ground. You have probably been in that sort of situation, seeing something unfold and wondering exactly what's real and what's not. Perhaps out of your own experience, you could name what you thought might be happening at the table or down the road or outside in the other apartment. Perhaps you tried to ignore it all. But there are those like me who, like Marge in the story, want to know what is going on. We each wonder at times whether other people's lives are similar to ours. How can we not? Often our lives roll on and roll on, and we just project that they must be the same in some way, even though we experience day in and day out that they're not. And so it's useful to take times, whether it's a story like this or using television shows, reading books, to see what it's like through the eyes of different people. When I was a kid, summer was a great time for me to try to practice that. I grew up in North Carolina, and each summer we would go to a theme park called Carowinds. A couple of you have nodded. Carowinds is on the border of North Carolina and South Carolina. And while that absolutely doesn't matter at all, it did to teenage, adolescent boys in high school who thought that that was the most important thing in the world. And so each summer we would go and we would make fun of the kids on the other side of the state line, or we would threaten to withhold our dollars from the stores in the South Carolina state because, of course, North Carolina was better. I can only imagine that there were some kids from high school, probably from Gaffney or Spartanburg, some other little town in South Carolina who went to the same theme park, who had the same mentality and wondered what those idiots from up north were doing. Why did they run that way and wear those hats? That sort of experience of who are you and what makes you choose to do what you do is not unique to any of us. We are taught in so many ways to discern who we are in the world vis-a-vis the people around us. Us versus them. You're either with us or against us. The good guys versus the bad guys. Unfortunately, much of the time, this identity formation is located in the negative space. I know that I'm a good person because I am not from South Carolina, for instance. Right? That works. For me, you know, I am not a Christian. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in this. I'm not a Republican or a Democrat or an independent. We do that more negative piece as opposed to the I am. I am a believer in such and such. I do believe in this or that. It's not uncommon for us, and yet it's something that we can work to get out of, to develop that identity a little bit more. The question is, how do we encounter and experience the others and their identities without judging them too harshly, nor taking them on ourselves? This is a question of intercultural competence. It's a question of, can you be you in the same space, on the same common ground as me, without either of us feeling the need to change who we are because of it? Not that we can't learn, that we can't share ideas, but that it's okay to be me. One example I use is from a recent wedding Anise and I did here at Brew. The couple was a fantastic couple. Some of the most creative, artistic minds. Jolene knows this too. Amazingly beautiful art. And as often happens, there were assumptions made. And so I noticed right before the wedding, the young man who was planning much of this handed me a script. And in the script, it asked me to do something, to allow the father of the bride to give the bride away. And I said, I don't do that. And there was this moment of tension, because in many ways, what he said was, I came to you, I came to a Unitarian Universalist church because you do anything. What do you mean? You don't do that. I said, well, let's talk about this. I can't, with good integrity to myself, ask this person to give someone else away as though they're property. I can't, and I won't. Now, this was within 48 hours of the wedding. They were here from New York, and things were not, I mean, there was some, like, anxiety, because this was a big production. So I didn't want to press too hard. But part of being a Unitarian Universalist is to know who we are and what we believe, with the ability to understand that that may have worked for their family and made sense in their culture, but it's not my culture. And I am not obliged to change my ethics or my theology or my beliefs and praxis for them. That can be hard to do sometimes when we want to be tolerant of others and we want to be open to change. And so the question is, how do we balance it? How do we balance it all instead of being the church where we can do anything, which means we do everything, or a church where we figure it out for ourselves and work together? Now, some of this is about how we are as people. I recognize that many of us don't intentionally do this, but it's a common experience. Social psychologist Gustav Eichhauser says that we cast ourselves alone thinking that only we know the right way. Only we are the ones who can find the right path, hence the story for all ages that my path will be the one that gets me there, and you all are crazy for not following. Gustav writes, we tend to resolve our perplexity arising out of the experience that others are different by declaring that they are in some sort of defect, unable to see things as they really are, quote unquote, and to react to them in a normal way. We thus imply, of course, that things are in fact as we see them, and that our ways are the normal ways. Religiously, that's true as much as it is politically or socially or anything else. Early in life, I was encouraged to feel a certain pride in being a member of a certain faith or nationality or a member of a state of North Carolina. This us versus them was taught early. But somewhere along the way, there were some good friends and teachers, and I got to meet mentors who would help me realize that everyone had to experience that change and diversity for themselves. And in so doing, I could open up to new ideas. Well, of course they would see it differently. Why wouldn't they? Perhaps you too were like that, noticing that everyone thought of themselves as right, but you had questions about that. This isn't a call for a whole cultural relativism. I must admit my own sort of knee-jerk response to that, wanting there to be some rights and some wrongs in the world. Instead, it's a call to look at our lives and make some sense out of it, to test it against science and belief and logic, while also being open to experience and truth. Finding our identity, whatever it is, can be really difficult. Often we think that it's going to happen in adolescence. That's the space that we give to it, whether it's junior high school or high school, maybe young adulthood. But then we spend so much more time outside of that, as adults, moving along, and yet spend less time finding our identity in the positive and developing it than we did earlier. I believe that there was probably a time in our world where those who were in power, whether it was a religious leader, not unlike myself, political leaders, people related to education, whatever the case, that there were leaders who said, you know, there's only one truth, that we should all be the same homogenized society where everyone looks the same and sounds the same and says the same thing. And of course, people heard that and recognized that idea as ridiculous. Because, of course, I believe that, so it must be ridiculous, right? My truth is the normal truth. And so society rebelled. People had the tools to say, are you kidding me? We are not bound by your identity, by the dominant culture, the hegemony, the patriarchy, the racism. We're not going to swallow idiotic beliefs because that's how it's always been. And so people walked away. They created their own groups and identities, and in so doing, especially over the past couple decades, as technology has grown, we've breathed a sigh of relief that we are not alone. In many ways, for many people, that sigh of relief that we are not alone has been liberating. It's been good to know that we're not crazy for thinking that we have these thoughts, that we're different, and that there are others like us. John Donne wrote, "No man or no person is an island." But the shame and the isolation that some of the power brokers and institutions can use to make us feel that way, it can feel like we're isolated, that we're not connected to anyone, anywhere, or anything. We may not be alone, but it sure feels lonely sometimes. It's phenomenal how our technology can help us find common ground, find people who are incredibly similar to us. You can go online and find people who like the exact same movie quotes and ice cream flavors and toys from the 80s and cartoons, whatever you want. That's just what I Google search. You can find your own community. We can find those people, but finding them doesn't mean we walk a common path, that we make the connections we seek. This, in fact, is why our church exists. We ask people to come together out of their unique lives and experiences to build a community that celebrates assortment, diversity, and authenticity over assimilation. We value the art of being agreeable over the idea of agreeing on one truth. Whether it's something that I say or you say, we recognize that being agreeable with one another is more important than the relationship than the thing itself. We admittedly walk a fine line between allowing for an openness to new belief and discovery and an openness to all belief. I often refer people to a song by a musician that many of you have heard of. Culturally, for better or for worse, we are all about some folk music, as you use. I love it too, but we do it a lot. And so I think of Peter Mayer. Many of you know him, this guy in Minnesota with a guitar. And he has a song entitled Holy Now. And it's a beautiful song. And I think every time I listen to it, dude, I think you're wrong. I could be wrong, but I think he is wrong because he articulates that everything is holy, which is slightly different, but substantively different from the awareness that anything can be holy. We are called to look and to search and to dig for the holy in our lives, and maybe we do see it in everything. Maybe we find it hidden under rocks or up mountains or with people. But part of what it means is to come together as one community, even when we disagree on where we find the holy, to be holy with one another. So many times we come together out of hope and love to build something special. Our common ground is not laced with theological minerals of how many gods there are. It's laced with the theology that love and hope are more powerful than hatred and fear, and that by human hands we can rid the world of both of those. Like almost every group in the world, we say that when any two of us are gathered, there are three or more opinions. More often than not, we say this with some exasperation. As we look at the clock during the annual meeting and wonder if we can't just move this along, and it's true that we have often, or at least occasionally, let this get in the way of good work, sacrificing direction for the sake of dialogue. But there is some truth in the adage. It's in our ability and willingness to question and reflect that we, as a humanity, has moved the earth from the center of the universe, that we have moved and found ways to extend and improve our physical and mental and spiritual lives. We are the heirs to the religious heritage of heresy, and therefore are charged with asking hard questions, both of ourselves and one another. Part of our common ground is to accept that we could be wrong. One of my colleagues, a minister, has a tattoo that says, "You could be wrong." Any number of UU ministers like to poke and prod him to say, "It would have been a little bit better, Patrick, if it had said, I might be wrong." But that takes a different sense of humility. Speaking of that sense of being wrong, but loving all the same, here's where I leave us on a deeper truth. One of my all-time favorite factoids, as a lover of trivia, earlier in the sermon I cut it, but I talked about, you know, in high school, many of us knew where we fit into a niche, and once we become adults, it's not so clear. High school, we're freaks or geeks or jocks, musicians, all that stuff. Well, I was definitely one of the geeks. I did trivia. So this is one of my favorite things. It's a common phrase in Unitarian Universalism. It's the definition of who we are as a church. Francis David was a Transylvanian. He helped Transylvania become one of the first places to have religious tolerance legalized as a part of who they were. Unitarianism became a state religion. And so our story goes that he said, "You need not think alike to love alike." That's so true. That's our phrase. You need not think alike to love alike. And I recall Patrick's arm tattoo because that's not at all an accurate quote. It's true. I love the quote. That if we find common ground with people who are different from us, if we're willing to look beyond labels and look to the heart and soul, we can build strong, lasting community, regardless of whether you believe in God or not, the afterlife, all of that. It takes love to walk this common ground we're on. But it wasn't Francis David. It wasn't even a UU who read his stuff and tried to paraphrase him. It was John Wesley, founder of Methodism. And it's with his awesome phrase that we center our faith of an open and free church, clearly living out the principle that we welcome all religious truths, or at least many of them, and that truly we need not think alike to love alike. That's the spirit of this church. Amen, and blessed be.